backs up. Okay, welcome back to Raising Children Who Love Their Savior. Last time we had started our second section. It's entitled, God Has Put You in Charge, Mom and Dad. And we began looking at what God's Word has to say about how parents are God's representatives. We had pretty much gotten through the first page and about halfway through the second page. So that's where we'll pick it up on the back side of the first sheet today. Greg, if you could maybe just let this here for about 5 minutes to make sure everybody arrives and then send it around. Please sign up on the sign-up sheet, circle the number next to your name, and if you are new today, welcome. And please add yourself to the bottom of the list. Okay, we had left off with the Leviticus passage last time, and we're starting these two longer sections from Matthew's Gospel where Jesus talks about authority in general. You will remember that last time my introduction to this section talked about how our society today does everything it can to take authority out of the hands of parents and place it into the hands of children, right? The world, manufacturers like to have the decision-making process in the hands of children so that children can determine where the buying power of the household goes, right? They have been sly enough to figure this out, and it's one of the things that makes life as a parent difficult. So, of course, we said what we want to do is rediscover these scriptural principles, what God teaches about where authority rests in the household, so that our houses can run in a manner that is going to bring all the praise and glory to Jesus, right? For everything that goes on in the household. And the two longer sections that I've taken for today, they don't apply specifically to the family relationship, but I thought it was important for us to see some comments that Jesus makes simply on the topic of authority, of who's in charge, and we're going to apply these principles then to the family situation. The first one is the one where Jesus and the centurion have this exchange. It's Matthew chapter 8. Did everybody get a copy of the handout? If you have the same one from, it's the same one from last week. If you need a new one, there's some on the stand over there. When Jesus had entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him asking for help. Lord, he said, my servant lies at home paralyzed and in terrible suffering. Jesus said to him, I will go and heal him. The centurion replied, Lord, I do not deserve to have you come under my roof, but just say the word and my servant will be healed. For I myself am a man under authority, with soldiers under me. I tell this one, go, and he goes, and that one, come, and he comes. I say to my servant, do this, and he does it. When Jesus heard this, he was astonished and said to those following him, I tell you the truth, I have not found anyone in Israel with such great faith. Then Jesus said to the centurion, go, it will be done just as you believed it would. And his servant was healed at that very hour. Now, what are some of the things that we can glean from this account from the life of Jesus about people in authority? First of all, I think it's important for us to notice the other main character in the account besides Jesus is this centurion. Why would he be a likely person to understand how authority works? Mark.
Well, in the military, they have certain authority. It's just like you have your general, your major, your colonels, and it's like they know the chain of command as far as authority goes, because right, that's what rules and governs them.
Exactly. In the military, you understand the chain of command, right? Why does the chain of command exist in the military? What is the reason that every private cannot do what he or she pleases, but has to follow the order of someone else? But tell me more about authority. Why is this a necessity in the military way of life?
After the French Revolution, the democracy was such a popular idea that the soldiers felt they should be able to vote whether they were going to fight a battle or not, and so they lost all their battles until Napoleon came along.
Is that right? That's a historical fact. Did everybody hear John? He said after the French Revolution, there was a period where the soldiers, because of the newfound democracy, the soldiers felt that they could vote whether they wanted to go into battle, and that's why they lost every battle until Napoleon took over and reestablished authority, evidently, huh? Yeah. Yeah. Daphne.
Isn't that the organization of the chain of command is chaotic? Everybody can just do what they want.
Right. Yeah, otherwise there would be chaos, right? When you think of the huge operations that an army must undertake, it simply would be chaos to have everybody doing what he thinks is right, right? So you have the chain of command. Daphne was making a little pyramid there, right? Where there's one final person where the buck stops. I suppose in our system in America it would be the President of the United States, right? Because he's the commander in chief. But depending on the level of importance of the decision that's made, you know, the chain of command may have to function from the very top or somewhere in the middle if it's not as important a decision, right? In order for a huge operation like the protection of an entire country to function properly, right? Now apply that to the family. In order for the family to function in order, there must be a chain of command too, right? God has put mother and father in charge of the household, right? Notice how Jesus compliments this centurion because he understands this aspect of authority, right? And of course, he especially compliments the man's faith, right? Because this man has insight to know that this isn't just an army that we're talking about here. This is the Lord of the universe, right? Who he is recognizing in Jesus. And he is willing to put all of his trust in this person. Jesus wants to go to the man's house. The man says, no, just say the word and it will happen. Because I give the commands to my soldiers and they have to do what I say. So you give the command and I know that my servant will be well. Now, let's apply it a little more specifically to the situation that we have in our homes. My kids are getting toward the stage where I want to start giving them more and more freedom, but I'm surprised how often they will still come up to me, Sam's going to be 11, and say, can I have, you know, a snack or whatever it is? And I'm surprised that the chain of command is still working this late in the process, that there isn't a sense of, well, when I get hungry, I go and have a snack. If you establish the chain of command early on, it will work well down the road for you, okay? If they understand who's in charge and what their role is. You know, we print those suggestions in the main page every week. And I came across a good one just a couple of weeks ago that I wanted to make sure to share with you. When do you start handing over decisions to your children? There was some good practical advice in the main page a couple of weeks ago. It was about when do you let them decide what they want for lunch? The piece of advice that was given in the main page on that day was, if they can begin to make the choice of what they want, then hand over to them also the responsibility of packing the lunch. Did you catch that one? Attach responsibility to choice, right? Isn't that where our world has gone wrong in a lot of ways? We give choice out free of charge, and we don't attach it to responsibility, right? If there is freedom of choice in matters like what I'm going to have for lunch that day, then some responsibility needs to go along with it. That will help the child to understand why the chain of command is there, right? Because it costs money to get the food to put in the lunchbox, right? Because mom has to go through the work of packing the lunch. That's what gives me such wonderful choices today, right? Okay? Any other comments or questions that you would have in connection with that one? Okay, then let's go on to the next account of Jesus, because I always think this next account of what Jesus has to say here is the most important thing to remember when it comes to authority within a Christian context. Understanding that I'm not dictator in my house, but that everything that I do as a leader is a response to what Jesus has done for me. And that it all flows from the love of God and the gospel. Matthew 20. Then the mother of Zebedee's sons came to Jesus with her sons and kneeling down asked a favor of him. What is it you want? He asked. She said, grant that one of these two sons of mine may sit at your right and the other at your left in your kingdom. You don't know what you are asking, Jesus said to them. Can you drink the cup I am going to drink? We can, they answered. Jesus said to them, you will indeed drink from my cup, but to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they have been prepared by my Father. When the 10 heard about this, they were indignant with the two brothers. Jesus called them together and said, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. The world's idea of authority is quite naive, isn't it? They think that authority is this wonderful power that if I get in the position of authority, then I will be able to lord it over everyone. And James and John's mother's comments smack of that, right? Jesus, let these two sons of mine be the second and third in command in your kingdom. Boy, what an honor that would be, right? And Jesus has to remind her that what is always attached to leadership or authority in the Christian context?
Service,
right? Parents are not dictators in their house. They are the chief servants in the house, right? Jesus Christ, who we could say is at the head of the command, right? He came and served as a servant for us. So in the same way, when we take the lead in our houses, we have to always have in mind that we are the servants. Notice even how Jesus has the chain of command idea in mind so much that when he turns the mother of James and John down, what reason does he give as to why he will not decide it?
It's not his decision, right?
Whose decision is it, does he say? The Father, notice a familial term, right? Emphasizing how he is the Son, how God is his Father. I'm sure what plays into it too is Jesus' humiliation, you know, being a human being like us. There are certain comments that come up in his talking with the disciples when they ask what is the day on which he's going to return, and he says no one knows that day, not even the angels nor the Son, but only the Father, right? He often points to that, I guess you could call it chain of command, to emphasize that there are certain decisions in life that simply are not in our hands. Isn't that an important thing to teach children too as they're growing up? That there are certain things that don't always have a clear reason, or I will never be able to decide that. There are certain things in life that are rather mysterious, that God has a reason for happening. We can't explain fully, but we simply have to accept them, right? That's a very important lesson for children to learn, because they start out like James and John's mother, right? They want to, they're even patient maybe, and they're thinking to themselves, well, by the time I reach 14, can I, at our house, one of the things that we held in abeyance for a long time was a bird. I don't know if you heard the bird story. Maddie got a bird for her birthday, and for a long time it was, you're not going to get a bird until you're 18. Well, she wore us down, what can I say? But there are just certain things that a child has no control over and will never have any control over. There are certain other things that we reach a certain age and we hand control over to them, right? But they usually are rather insignificant things, right? They're not the important things of life. They are things like pets, right? That have with them their own teaching, you know, their own lessons that are wrapped into them. Now you have to clean the cage, right? Now you have to feed and water on a daily basis, that sort of thing. Pam?
I don't necessarily agree with that. You give them, what I the lesser things in life or the more insignificant things? Mm-hmm. Pet is a huge responsibility. If you're basically turning the majority of this responsibility over to a child, they're responsible for keeping that pet alive.
True.
And when you think of it that way, that's really good training for later, mm-hmm. you yeah. know, when they have to take care of themselves, mm-hmm. have primary responsibility for themselves, mm-hmm. and that family, and,
true.
And that kind of thing, that's, you know.
Another thing you have to keep in mind is the context in our house right now. One of the discussions we're having is, when is the age when Sam can stay home with Maddie alone? You know, so that's in connection with talking about taking care of the life of a bird as compared to taking care of the life of my sister or being responsible for my own self while mom and dad are out. Yeah, but you make a good point. Brett?
I don't know how to say this to make it make sense, but it's, I was always, Pastor Waterstead said something in a class maybe a year ago or so that really made a difference in my life, where he stressed that the most important or significant thing about God, the attribute that is the most significant and important, is his love. Mm-hmm. And it had always been hammered into me in, as I was growing up, that the, and not from my parents, but the church I was going to, is the most significant thing about God is his sovereignty and his power and his greatness. But we all have some sort of greatness in our lives. And there are people that are always, that we are responsible for. Mm-hmm. We are over, if you can put it that way. And if we don't have that love, mm-hmm. we're nothing, and we're not effective. And we may think we're effective, but we aren't. So it is truly God's power. I mean, his love, that is the most powerful part of it. Mm-hmm. And it kind of, we use that term love so loosely. But if you're an authority and you have love for those that you're responsible for, it is truly a sacrifice to love them and serve them.
Yes.
If you are underneath somebody in authority and you love them, it's more of a deference and honor to their authority as opposed to sacrificing for them, because they don't need you to sacrifice.
Yes.
And we have that so mixed up. We think people should love those above us, and we need to be powerful over those below us.
Yeah.
It's so messed up.
We try to change attitudes by using power, by using our authority as parents, right? Rather than using our love for them as the motivating force, right? Brett really summed up nicely the entire point of the entire course, right? That's what we're trying to emphasize in this course. Motivating with the gospel rather than with the law, right? And Jesus captures that so nicely in this account, right? The mother of James and John is law-oriented, right? She wants some of that power for her sons. She's enamored with the idea of God's majesty, right? Just like Brett was saying. But majesty alone does not motivate good behavior, right? So we as parents, with the authority that God has entrusted to us, we need to understand that it always has to have that crucial part of love in the things that we say and do to our children if we are going to motivate them to do what God wants them to do, right? Because it is only the gospel that gives proper motivation. Yeah, exactly. Pam.
One of the things that you give kids to do as they're growing up, you want them to focus on that, those aspects of being a servant when you have authority. Mm-hmm. Also, there's great responsibility when you have authority too.
Yeah.
You're responsible for the people under you. You know, and
right.
That with that Brett was saying that you have to do it out of love. You do your service out of love to the people who are under you, but you also have that great responsibility to take care of them and
right. Yeah. Good combination there, right, of service and responsibility, right? Those two must go hand in hand the more our children are growing up, right? That they need to recognize that they are servants too, to their mom and dad, to their brother and sister, right? As well as having authority or responsibility for something very important in life. Brett.
Well, I agree, because we see Jesus serve and we follow his example. You know, he's our model mm-hmm. for how we do serve and how we love others. But I think, too, it's so easy to slip into that thing of, I'm an authority over these people and their job is to do things for me. I mean,
yeah.
As an employer, I get caught into that trap so often. And that's not why there's that level of authority in my,
yeah.
my job.
Yeah.
You know, it's because I need to have that motivation to serve that person. I've been placed in that position. God put me there for that person, not for mm-hmm. me.
Yeah. It doesn't all come back to the person in authority, right? The command isn't given for the good of the person giving the command, right? But rather, it's done for the good, really, of everybody who's involved in the situation.
It's like good things are handed down. Mm-hmm. They're not delivered up.
Yeah.
I mean, God gives us everything we need.
Yeah.
And then we transfer those things on down.
Good way of saying it. Good things are delivered down to us rather than handed up, right? That's what God's grace is all about, right? That it comes from Him and it penetrates down to each one of us. And then it motivates what we do for Him, right? Do you see how Brett's little thought that he's setting in front of us is a beautiful example of law and gospel? That it begins with the grace of God, right? And then I'm motivated to do, you know, what's good for the God who blessed me so richly. And for the people around me, too. Yeah, good point. Anything else in the account there that Jesus gives of authority through service? Okay, then let's go to the next section, which is entitled, How Do I Take Charge? I put this next bullet point in bold type because it's a little phrase that somebody gave to me way back when I was in college, and it has always stuck with me. It's really a thought-provoking phrase. Command respect, don't demand it. Do you understand what that phrase is saying? command respect is simply do something, give a command, and see to it that it's carried out in your house, but don't kind of become a nag about it. Always saying, now you didn't do that, you didn't pick up your clothes when I told you. How many times do I have to tell you? When you start to slip into the complaining mode or the nagging mode, you've kind of lost the battle. You see the point that I'm making there? Command respect, don't demand it. If you find that you begin to say more words than are worth what is getting accomplished by the thing that you've given the order for, you've lost the battle already. Then regroup. Stop the whole process, rethink what you're doing and how it is that you slipped into that bad habit, and take charge again and begin to speak authoritatively in your home. What it says there is, be careful not to fall into the trap of nagging your children into obeying you. Speak and act decisively and authoritatively. I always welcome, does anybody have any little devices maybe that they've tried in their own home that has worked with this? Mark?
Well, our boys, they usually like a little bit of a warning. We found that this has really been helpful for us in the set of parenting class, that we give them kind of like a 5-minute or a 2-minute warning about something. So that they, when they're doing something they're really engrossed in, it really helps them to break away from it. Because, I mean, I'm the same way. If I'm doing a project, and if Michelle were to come and say, Mark, we're going to eat right now, I say, oh, shoot, you know, if we told me 5 minutes ago, I kind of can wound things up. So we do that with them, and it really helps, because all we have to do is say, boys, 5 minutes, we're going to be eating, so start winding it down. And that makes them obey a whole lot better than we used to before. It's like, hey, boys, time to go. And they'd be like, what? You know, I'm in the middle of this. And it just helped us with those guys following through with our commands that we wanted them to do. The compliance was much, much better.
Preventative medicine, right? Give warnings before the deadline rather than waiting for the deadline to arrive and then nagging afterwards, right? Maybe we could jump to where the rubber meets the road, because I've got a scenario set up there that fits in well with that. You maintain a consistent bedtime in your home. You put your 4-year-old daughter to bed every night at 8 o'clock, but she continually gets up and comes into the living room to ask you one more question, is what she always says. You say to her each time, go to bed, but she keeps getting up anyway. You're beginning to feel that your commands to her are becoming meaningless. What do you do? Mark has a solution for that, right? You say, while she's playing yet at 7:30 or maybe 7:45, something like that, okay, 15 minutes, and by that time all the toys need to be picked up and it's time for prayers and we're in bed, right? And then maybe give another warning at 5 minutes too, or something like that. Okay? That way you don't have to slip into angry voice, right? Which is always detrimental once you start getting into that, right? Then you got to start thinking of, well, what's the consequences going to be the next time I have to say something? Mark?
I was going to say, and this one right here too, again, it comes out if you're talking about like routine. It's like, we know our boys' bedtime's 8 o'clock, but at 7:30 we start to read a book, then we say our prayers, and then we go to bed. You know, but it's something that we have to start at 7:30, not 8 o'clock.
Right. Having a ritual with something like this helps, right?
Yeah.
That we know we wash, we brush our teeth at a certain time in the process, maybe we read a book, we say our prayers, you know, and then that's the signal to them that it's time to do, you know, the laying down. Joyce?
The other thing is, I know my daughter, the old one, would say, oh, I need to drink water. So we just put a cup in the bathroom, go get some water.
Again, preventative medicine, right? If you know what the problem is going to be, do something that will be a solution to it before the situation ever comes up, right? Carolyn?
If my daughter were a little older than this, I would make her go to bed maybe 6 minutes early. They kept looking around.
so they had to get attendance. And then that wasn't working out, it was 10 minutes earlier. So they finally got the message that mine, you know.
Ah, okay. Pulling the bedtime forward if there was goofing around. So that the more goofing around, the earlier you had to go to bed, giving incentive then to, well, if I want to stay up the latest, then I've got to. Carolyn's idea may be a good one in certain situations. Is it a law or a gospel-oriented way of handling? It is a law way of handling, right? So you're going to have to be careful with that, and you're going to have to keep that in mind, right? It may be necessary because of situations getting out of hand to do it that way, but it is law motivation. Okay? Any other people who have ever had that particular problem? The scenarios that I've come up with in the where the rubber meets the road section are sometimes ones that happen in our own home, and you can guess who the little girl is in this one. Because she has a lot of energy and 8 o'clock is an early bedtime for her. And we had this situation for quite some time when she was around the age of 4, where we constantly said, it's time to go to bed, it's time to go to bed, and it just simply became meaningless because she came out each time. And one night something happened that was a learning moment for me. Instead of saying anything, I simply stood up and I grabbed her very firmly and we walked very quickly into the bedroom. And she could tell that something was different and it made her very nervous. And I deposited her in bed that time and she did not come out afterwards. And I learned that simply taking action is sometimes much louder to children than saying words all the time. If our words become meaningless, then we are abusing our command even. We're not using it in the wisest way possible. That's why back up under how do I take charge, I put the phrase in there, speak and act decisively and authoritatively. If what you say is not something that you can carry through on or are likely to carry through on, then don't say it, right? Because otherwise you are ahead of time undermining your own authority. Okay? Pam?
That was something I always had trouble with, that you want them to succeed, so you think you're being helpful in reminding them of what they need to do, and it just, there comes a point where you're going, you know what, this really isn't working, and you just had to, you know, stop the words, and you, because the more words you used, I always noticed the louder my voice tended to get.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you know, it's something that I didn't know I was still working on. When she gets to her age, where that's going to be an issue. But just, you know, saying, okay, this is what we're doing, and quietly taking action is so much better than loudly saying.
Right. It shows that you are in control, right? If you are in a softer tone of voice. Right, rather than you're getting... do you realize that what sometimes happens when we're trying to train our children is that they actually train us? They know the situation well enough, and they know how far they can push the envelope. They know the exact decibel that your voice has to get to when they say, okay, now I better do it or I'm really in trouble, right? And they're causing your behavior patterns to develop, right? Rather than you causing their behavior patterns to develop. You see what I'm saying? They can train you without you even realizing it. They're not realizing what they're doing. Oh, I suppose subliminally or somehow they know they're in control of the situation, but that's exactly what is happening. They are showing you that they are in charge. So take a step back. Don't become angry. Because see, that's exactly what the situation is bringing about, right? That something, a change is happening in you rather than a change in them, right? So just take a step back, take a deep breath, as we always say in our house, take a cleansing breath. Reanalyze the situation, and come up with your next best strategy for how to handle the situation. Keeping in mind exactly what Brett was talking about before, that love needs to be the motivating force in the entire situation, right? Yeah.
Actually, I had a second. I'm always reminded, someone told me that when you get angry, someone else has control over you. Mm-hmm. So you don't want to give that control to your kids.
Exactly.
This is not a fair question. I realize that because there are so many situations this could apply to where it's not appropriate. However, there are some times when my daughters don't respond or they rebel or they start crying or they just don't do what I ask them to do. Mm-hmm. And it helps if I just go in not angry and find out what it is that's keeping them from being obedient. Maybe it's clean your room or whatever they say. And finally, when they let themselves down, it's like, I don't know where to start. Mm-hmm. There's an opportunity to help teach them how to organize a project or something mm-hmm. like that.
Yeah.
However, you know, I realize sometimes you need to just do the action. But sometimes I may think there's a problem, and that's not the problem. There's something mm-hmm. else going on.
Right.
And it's something that can be handled.
As you're regrouping, Brett's advice is good, right? Gather input from them. It's not that you're asking them to solve the situation, but maybe you don't know why they're reacting the way that they are, right? And by understanding what's going on inside of their head, you can better apply principles of law and gospel in how you handle the situation, right? Good point.
So many times it's happened with my youngest that the reason she's just frozen is she thinks everybody's angry at her. And just sitting down and talking to you, showing her that we're not angry, she realizes she doesn't have to get upset. And then she can go ahead and carry on. But she just is terrified sometimes that she's lost that connection.
So. Yeah. It's often fear that's causing the reaction, right? And fear is brought about by the law, right? Not by the gospel. The gospel never brings about the reaction of fear. So understanding, well, why are you afraid? And sitting down and talking, Brett's got some really good advice here too. Talking through the situation so they understand why is 8 o'clock the rule in the house, right? And going through tomorrow's school, right? And in order to function well in school, you have to have a good night's sleep, right? And going through, like we said before, all the blessings that are connected with being a member of this family, the blessings that go with having a Christian education, you know, helping them to see why we have rules in the house will help them to respond better. If it's based on the blessings that come through this order that we've set up in our Christian household. Right? Pam? Natural consequences, right? Where when you have the opportunity on a weekend or during summer vacation, let them stay up till whatever time. And then talk about the consequences the next morning when they're very tired. Another good suggestion, right? Children have varying needs as far as sleep is concerned, and then having a reading time after 8 o'clock where you have to be in your bed, but you can be doing something with your light on. That's been our solution too, because Sam is much more of a sleeper than Maddie is. She can stay up till 11 o'clock sometimes, even on a school night. And so reading time, you know, having something really constructive during that time can be helpful. Any other input, questions, or insights? Jack?
Well, I found out many years ago that you get authority by demanding.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can't, like when I was in the Army, I had a group of men there that I told them what I was going to do, and they had to do this,
mm-hmm.
and there was no argument about it.
Yeah.
That's the way it had to be done.
Exactly. Jack makes a really good point, too. I think what he meant by that was by commanding it, according to my little phrase anyway, right? Authority does begin with me giving an order, right? In a certain sense. You can't just wait around till they notice, hey, mom and dad are pretty good. Hey, they know quite a bit. Maybe we should follow them, right? A house isn't going to work that way, right? So from day one, you need to assert your authority, right? It's something that they need to learn by you teaching it to them, right? We're not just going to wait till the troops are mature enough to understand that you're in authority and then you start exercising it. From day one, you have to command it, right? To command respect. And then they will rally around you. Exactly. That's how authority works, right? Let's go on to the next bullet point. When your children defy your authority or question why you are in charge, tell them that it is God who puts you in charge. Explain to them the blessings that God intends them to have by placing you over them. Now notice, I'm saying you as parents need to say it explicitly. You can't just let them gather it from going to church or going to school and learning and assuming, okay, God has put you in this place. You have to explicitly tell them. The reason that I'm in charge of our house is because God has given us our house. And God has given me you. He blessed me so richly when He sent you into our house. And He wants me to be the leader for you. You see what I'm saying? Tell it to them explicitly. That is the best way for them to learn it. Now, we think according to our adult minds, right, that if somebody told us that, well, we would respond with, well, you know, where is it written down that you're the one in charge? Little kids don't think that way. You know, they live in a whole different thought world, and they can see that this room, you know, has been provided by mom and dad, who have provided all the teddy bears that are in it and stuff, and they're going to follow your line of thinking, hook, line, and sinker. They're not going to come up with all kinds of sophisticated arguments why you're not in charge. See, that's why it's important to tell them this from little on, from the time that they can first understand it, that yes, I am in charge here. And they'll follow like the little ducklings going after the mother duck. Right? Mark, it looked like you had one.
I was going to say, you're very right, because most kids under the age of 6, they think that parents, mom and dad, are the most powerful beings in the world, and they can literally produce anything for them that they want. They think... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they look for who is that authority figure, right? I always tell the joke about my nephews. Dorcas, as you know, is from the East Coast, and her pastor is Pastor Beckman, who's a very tall guy. He's about 6'6". And when I first knew Dorcas, the kids, her nephews, were like 6 years old or something like that. One of the questions that came up one day, is Pastor Beckman as big as God? You know, they're trying to discover these interrelationships of different people, right? And trying to fit in, well, who's the one in charge, you know, over everything? Because like Pastor Beckman was in charge of the whole congregation. He wasn't just in charge of one family, right? And where does God fit into it all? You know, they want to. They have a natural curiosity about this. Who is in charge of who, right? So don't be afraid to tell them. They want to know that information. And if they know, as Brett was telling us before, that it's motivated, that the motivation is the love of God in everything, well, then they're naturally going to follow it. Oh, God gave me a mom and dad because He loves me. Oh, you know, then they're going to view you in a whole different way than if I'm in charge here because I say so, right? Anything else on that bullet point, John?
I think if you don't tell them that, by the time they get public school, they'll be told that it's an old patriarchal system to defy authority.
Yeah. There are plenty of people waiting to disabuse them of that idea, right? That it's just an old custom that parents are in charge and it's something you need to rebel against, right? That's going to come quick enough. So tell them the good news ahead of time, right? That you really are in charge. Okay, going on to the third bullet point. Oh, okay.
You know, we're talking about how do you insert the gospel and not always the law. That is good news about who is in charge. It's not oppressive by any means.
No.
Because we're looking for that protection, that provision, and what wonderful news. I mean, we all look for that.
Yeah.
We will try to find a leader in a group if it's not somebody else, it'll be us and they're looking at us.
Yeah.
And that is...
Yeah, it's part of the good news, isn't it? It's kind of one of those rays that kind of radiates out from the gospel. It's not the gospel itself. The gospel, of course, is that we are saved through Jesus Christ, right? But it's one of those blessings that follow the good news, that flow out of the good news, that he's even watched out for my physical well-being and provided a leader for me that I can follow, right? Okay, third bullet point. Make it clear to your children that you are in charge and that it's a good thing for them. The exact point Brett was just making. Every group of human beings has a hierarchy or pecking order. Each member of the group feels secure when they know each person's role in the group. Children actually get a sense of security and safety when they know their parents are in charge. Do you realize that? Even at the stage where they're beginning to assert their independence, they still like to know that you're in charge. They're not going to admit it to you. They're in that stage where they have to put up the bold front and say, I want to do things my way, Mom and Dad. But it is still a comfort to them to know that someone else is in charge. Pastor Waterstrat tells the story that when his daughter was in high school, there were times where the peer group wanted to do something that she knew was wrong. And she would purposely go to him and ask him, Dad, can I do this? Knowing full well that he was going to say no, so that she could go back and face the peer group and say, no, my dad won't let me do that. Because that was easier at that point in development than to say to the friends, no, this is wrong and I don't want to do this. It was a safety valve for her that she could say to the peer group, no, my dad won't let me do this. You see what I'm saying? She was a teenager who was deriving comfort from the fact that Mom and Dad were in charge. Children like it when they know who's in charge. So again, another reason, parents, to assert your authority. The reason for our title today, God has put you in charge, Mom and Dad. It is not a bad thing. You are not an ogre carrying around a big club ready to clobber somebody when they step out of line. God has put you in a very secure position. You don't have to worry about where you get your authority from. You know it comes from God. Just carry out that authority. It's a natural thing in God's world. John.
Sometimes in that case, you hear people say, well, give the child the option of making the decision so that they can make a responsible decision. Mm-hmm. But then as soon as they make a decision, you know they shouldn't have, then
what do you do, huh?
You can't be mad about it.
Yeah. It's important to have thought through those kind of scenarios, right? If you're going to give the option to the children, the decision, in a certain situation, then you've got to think through in your mind, what if they make the right decision? What if they make the wrong decision? Can I live with their wrong decision? Can they live with their wrong decision, right? You got to have thought that all through. Exactly. We've got a where the rubber meets the road that's going to fit well into John's comment here. Let's go to the fourth bullet point. By carefully building an environment in which your children love and respect you, you are actually teaching them, by extension, to love and respect God. By specifically explaining to your children what God has done for them and what He expects of them, you will be instilling in them a deeper, more compelling reason to obey you than if you simply say to them, "Do this because I said so." You see the law and the gospel in that little paragraph there? You need to tell them, first of all, what God has done for them. And then tell them, too, unashamedly, what God expects of them. And the gospel will be there to implant that proper motivation for wanting to do the good thing. And as John is saying in his little scenario there, then choosing the right thing when you finally giving them the option, and then you can kind of cheer secretly, probably not in front of them, but say, "Yeah, they made the right decision." The law and the gospel worked in their proper proportions, and the gospel motivated them to do what is right. Okay? So always make sure that they understand that extension, that when they're obeying you, when they're showing love and respect for you, they are by extension showing love and respect for God. Any points on the fourth bullet point? Anything that comes to your mind? Any questions? Any comments? The last bullet point is one that just somebody pointed out to me recently, so I kind of threw it in there. It doesn't really fit with how do I take charge, but remember, family is not a democracy. Otherwise, when the third child comes, the children could outvote the parents. It's not majority rules, right? Family was never set up to be a democracy. And yet, so often in our good American way, we try to turn it into that, right? That it's just five people with five equally valid opinions on things, and that's not what God says. Let's go, our time is running out, so let's go to that second where the rubber meets the road topic. Your 16-year-old son wants to go to his friend's co-ed slumber party. You tell him no, patiently explaining to him that the situation would create certain temptations that are better left avoided. Your son responds that the kids who are attending the party are good kids and reminds you that the boy who is hosting has responsible parents that you know and trust. How do you respond to your son? I don't know, since our last class, you took it home. I don't know if you had any time during the 2 weeks to think through this one. This would be one of those, like John was talking about, where is this the kind that you want to allow the decision into their hands when a yes decision or a no decision could be something hard to live with? Kim?
I would say that.
Ah, that might be a solution, right? Go to the party part, but be picked up when the slumbering part begins. And she's thinking especially about her daughter. Yes.
I'm just hard to get to the 16-year-old. If you really want to go that bad, maybe myself as a parent might have to stay too. If it's just be a party, nothing bad's going to happen. It's not going to be bad. Whether their parents are in the other room, I don't know that I necessarily say they could go either.
Maybe that's a solution. You go along as a chaperone.
Right?
Yeah. I thought long and hard about this one. The reason I put this one in is from talking to the Holmans for so many years, where I didn't realize it, but this is the common thing today, or at least it was when Adam and Chris were in high school, co-ed slumber parties of high school kids. And Jim and Cindy were always, you know, absolutely not. Adam and Chris did not go to those parties. But I also thought about it from the aspect of we sometimes have sleepovers here at church, you know, for the junior high group, especially likes to have them, where Jim keeps them up all night, you know, and maybe it would be that kind of situation too. I mean, where we just say we're not going to sleep the entire night, right? That might play into the decision.
So,
Pam?
But I think in the church situation, you know, like Jim Holman and the teachers and the people who are chaperoning, you know that they're going to be really watchful and make sure that they can understand that this is definitely not appropriate. Whereas if it's just something else that And in a house, there are lots of places where you're
Let me take the teenager's role once, though, and say, but Mom and Dad, you know Mr. and Mrs. Smith, and you really trust them, don't you, that they would be able to watch just as good as Mr. Holman would be able to at a... See what I'm saying? Then where do you draw the line? Because then you become the arbitrary judge of, well, it's okay in this situation, but it's not okay in that situation, right? And the teenage mind then instantly wants to zero in on the, you know, don't you trust me? You know, you let me do that and you don't let me do this. You really are the big meanie that all my friends say you are. Daphne? They just don't go.
They just know.
The boys know if the topic comes up, they don't go. Yeah, Jerry? That's right. Excellent point, right? That I, as the father in this family, am in charge with what this family does, and the other family, we admire them very much. They have other rules in their home, and those rules don't apply to us as people, right? As members of this family. Yeah, Pam?
You also have to decide when it's appropriate to have co-ed gatherings. That are family.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't think I ever went to a party that was co-ed until I was probably out of high school. I was an adult on my own.
Oh, really? At any type of party? I mean, even...
Just birthday parties. Okay, I rarely went to birthday parties, but it was always just girls.
Oh, really?
Never co-ed.
Yeah. This obviously is a situation, too, that you want to discuss with your children from little on. I can remember when Sam had Nick Webb over, when they were probably in first grade or something like that. And I think it was on a Saturday night, and they were going to take a bath. And as soon as they heard, Maddie heard that they were taking a bath, she said, I want to take a bath with Nick.
Yeah.
You know, so then you have to have an age-appropriate discussion with why boys don't take baths with girls. Right? So be talking with your children, you know, from a young age about the differences between boys and girls. By the way, let me put a plug in, because I just recently ordered these. Is everybody, well, I don't know if you're aware of it or not, but the Concordia Publishing House has a very good series from the books I've read on it about explaining sex to children. And it starts from little on. I mean, I think there's a book for 3 through 5 year olds. And then there's another one maybe from 5 to 7, and then from 8 to 11. I don't know the author of it. I only know there are two of them in the library right now, so that you could check some of them out to see what they're like. But then I could give you the 800 number for Concordia, so that you could order them for yourself. Because I just recently ordered them myself. You know what age my kids are at, so you know where I'm at in the stage of describing those type of things. But just so that you're aware of that. I guess our time is up. I didn't hear the bells ring yet. Any, Daphne?
What's the name of those books? Is there a title for them?
I don't know the title. If you go into our library right now, they're laying on the bottom shelf. And I can't remember the name of the series even.
Okay.
So I'll see you next week, and we'll continue with session 3. You can see some of the upcoming topics that are listed there. Yes, and if everybody could just help pick up the chairs, I'd appreciate it greatly.
It's a great divide and conquer one, because if one parent says, oh yeah, I like them, you know, they're nice people, and the girls could be set up on the board. And then the other parent says, no, I don't think, even if they're going to be safe.